I'm Tom Moreau, and you're listening to Radio Theater on WGXC 90.7 FM Creative Community Radio. Today we are listening in to Edgar Allan Poe, the noted mystery writer, as Halloween draws closer. Today we'll first hear two stories from Tales of Terror, read by Nelson Olmsted. First, A Cask of Amontillado, and then The Fall of the House of Usher. Then we'll hear Basil Rathbone take on Edgar Allan Poe with two stories, Alone and The City and the Sea, from Poems and Tales of Edgar Allan Poe, on Radio Theater on WGXC.
The thousand injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could. But when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. It must be understood that neither by word nor deed had I given Fortunato cause to doubt my goodwill. I continued, as was my wont, to smile in his face, and he did not perceive that my smile now was at the thought of his destruction. It was about dusk, one evening during the supreme madness of the carnival season, that I encountered my friend. He had been drinking much, and I was so pleased to see him that I thought I should never be done wringing his hand. I said to him, "Oh, by the way, my dear Fortunato, I'm glad we've met. I have received a bottle of what passes for Amontillado wine, and I have my doubts."
"A pipe of Amontillado? Oh, Montresor, that is impossible in the middle of the carnival. Amontillado, indeed."
"Yes, I was going to ask you to test it for me. But you're busy, so I'm on my way to Lucchese. If anyone has a critical turn, it is he."
"Lucchese can't tell Amontillado from sherry."
"And yet some fools will have it that his taste is a match for your own."
No. Come, let's go to your vaults. I'll tell you whether you have Amontillado or not. Lucchese can't distinguish sherry from Amontillado."
Thus speaking, Fortunato took my arm, and we hurried to the archway that led into the vaults beneath my palace. We passed down a long and winding staircase, coming at length to the foot of the descent, and stood together on the damp ground of the catacombs of the Montresors.
"Well, Montresor, where's this Amontillado you think you have?"
"Oh, it's farther on. But observe the white webwork which gleams from these cavern walls."
It's nitre. Nitre, isn't it?"
"Yes. How long have you had that cough?"
"Oh, no, it is nothing."
"Come, we'll go back. Your health is precious. You are rich, respected, admired, beloved. You are happy as once I was. You are a man to be missed. For me, it is no matter. We'll go back. You'll be ill, and I can't be responsible. Besides, there's Lucchese."
"Enough. The cough is a mere nothing. It won't kill me."
True. And indeed, I had no intention of alarming you unnecessarily. But you should use all proper caution here. A draught of this Medoc will defend us from the damp. Here, I knocked off the neck of a bottle, which I drew from a long row of its fellows that lay upon the mold. He raised it to his lips with a leer, and he said,
"I drink to the buried that repose around us.
And I drink to your life." The wine sparkled in his eyes as we proceeded. We passed through long halls of piled skeletons with casks and puncheons intermingling into the inmost recesses of the catacombs. I paused again, and this time I seized Fortunato by the arm above the elbow.
"The nitre, my dear Fortunato, you see, it increases. It hangs like moss upon the vaults. We are below the river's bed. The drops of moisture trickle among the bones. Come, we'll go back ere it's too late. Your cough..."
No, it's nothing. Let's go on. But first, please, another draught of the Medoc, if you don't mind."
I broke and handed him a flagon of de Grave. He emptied it in a breath. His eyes flashed with a fierce light. He laughed and threw the bottle upward. At the most remote end of the crypt, there appeared another, less spacious. Its walls had been lined with human remains, piled to the vault overhead in the fashion of the great catacombs of Paris. It was in vain that Fortunato, uplifting his dull torch, endeavored to pry into the depth of the recess. Its termination, the feeble light did not enable us to see. I said to him,
"Proceed, Fortunato. The Amontillado is in here."
My friend stepped unsteadily forward.
while I followed immediately at his heels. In an instant, he had reached the extremity of the niche, and finding his progress arrested by the rock, stood stupidly bewildered. In a moment more, and I had chained him to the granite. In its surface were two iron staples. Throwing the links of the chain around his waist, it was but the work of a few seconds to lock it. He was too much astounded to resist. Withdrawing the key, I stepped back from the recess, and then I said, "My dear Fortunato, pass your hand over the wall. You can't help feeling the nitre, can you? Indeed, it is very damp. Once more, let me implore you to return." "No? Then I must positively leave you."
But Montresor, the amontillado."
"True, the amontillado." As I said these words, I busied myself among the pile of bones of which I had just spoken. Throwing them aside, I soon uncovered a quantity of building stone and mortar, which I had placed there earlier. With these materials and with the aid of my trowel, I began to wall up the entrance of the niche. I had scarcely laid the first tier of the masonry when I discovered that the intoxication of Fortunato had in great measure worn off. The earliest indication I had of this was a low moaning cry from the depth of the recess. It was not the cry of a drunken man. There was then a long and obstinate silence. I laid the second tier, and the third, and the fourth, and then I heard the furious vibrations of the chain. The noise lasted for several minutes, during which, that I might listen to it with the more satisfaction, I ceased my labors and sat down upon the bones. And then at last the clanking subsided. I resumed the trowel and finished without interruption the fifth, the sixth, and the seventh tier. The wall was now nearly upon a level with my breast. I again paused, and holding the torch over the masonwork, threw a few feeble rays upon the figure within. It was now midnight, and my task was drawing to a close. I had completed the eighth, the ninth, and the tenth tier. I had finished a portion of the last and the 11th. There remained but a single stone to be fitted and plastered in. I struggled with its weight. I placed it partially in its destined position. But now there came from out the niche a slow laugh that erected the hairs upon my head. It was succeeded by a sad voice, which I had difficulty in recognizing as that of the noble Fortunato. The voice said,
"A very good joke indeed. An excellent jest. We will have many a rich laugh about it at the Palazzo. Yes, over the wine."
"Yes, over the amontillado."
"A very good joke indeed, an excellent jest. But will they not be awaiting us at the Palazzo, the Lady Fortunato and the rest? Let us be gone."
"Yes, let's be gone."
"For the love of God, Montresor."
"Yes, for the love of God."
But to these words I hearkened in vain for a reply. I grew impatient. I called aloud,
"Fortunato!"
No answer.
"Fortunato!"
No answer still. I thrust a torch through the remaining aperture and let it fall within. There came forth in return only a jangling of the chains. My heart grew sick on account of the dampness of the catacombs. I hastened to make an end of the labor. I forced the last stone into its position. I plastered it up. And against the new masonry, I re-erected the old rampart of bone. For the past half a century, no mortal has disturbed them. Un pace requiescat. During the whole of a dull, dark, and resoundless day in the autumn of the year, when the clouds hung oppressively low in the heavens, I had been passing alone on horseback through a singularly dreary tract of country, and at length found myself, as the shades of evening drew on, within view of the melancholy House of Usher. I know not how it was, but with the first glimpse of the building, a sense of insufferable gloom pervaded my spirit. I looked upon the scene before me, upon the mere house, upon the bleak walls, upon the vacant eye-like windows, upon a few white trunks of decayed trees, with an utter depression of soul. I finally forced myself to ride on to the house. The closer I got, the more abominable became this feeling of unutterable depression. A man took my horse and I entered to be greeted by my old schoolmate, Roderick Usher. I gazed upon him with a feeling half of pity, half of awe. Surely a man had never before so terribly altered in so brief a period as had Roderick Usher. Finally, he spoke of the object of my visit, for I had traveled far at his very earnest request to be with him in his gloomy hereditary castle. He mentioned his earnest desire to see me and of the solace he expected me to afford him. He entered at some length into what he conceived to be the nature of his malady. It was, he said, a constitutional and a family evil, and one for which he despaired to find a remedy. It was a fear, an uncontrollable fear, an oppressive gloom which pervaded his soul. It was, I concluded, a form of hereditary melancholia which was slowly driving him out of his senses. Moreover, to accentuate the symptoms was his avowed manner of living. He never at any time left the house for some indefinable fear of the tarn or marsh which surrounded the castle. Moreover, he was grieved with the long-continued illness and closely approaching death of a tenderly beloved sister, the Lady Madeline, his sole companion for long years, his last and only relative. Her death would leave him the last of the ancient race of the Ushers. For several days, I was busy in earnest endeavors to alleviate the melancholy of my friend. We painted and read together, or I listened as if in a dream to the wild improvisations of his squeaking guitar. I shall always remember the many solemn hours I spent trying to persuade him to return to a civilized world with me. But his fear, his ungrounded yet omnipresent fear, held him tenaciously to the place of his birth. One morning, with an unnatural firmness, Roderick abruptly informed me that the Lady Madeline was no more, that the strange disease had claimed her at last. Before I could state my profound sorrow at this ghastly news, he stated his intention of preserving her corpse for a fortnight before the final burial in one of the numerous vaults within the main walls of the building. So at his request, I personally aided in the arrangements for the temporary entombment. The body having been encoffined, we two alone bore it to its rest. The vault in which we placed it was small, damp. It was more of a dungeon than a vault, a dungeon which had most likely seen many horrors in the past centuries. We opened the door, a massive iron gate which was so immensely heavy that it caused an unusually sharp grating sound as it moved on its hinges. Once inside, we placed our mournful burden upon trestles and partially turned aside the yet unscrewed lid of the coffin, looking upon the young face of the Lady Madeline. The disease had left the mockery of a faint blush upon the bosom and the face, and that suspiciously lingering smile upon the lip which is so terrible in death. We replaced the lid and closed the door of iron. We made our way with toil into the scarcely less gloomy apartments of the upper portion of the house. For the next week, Usher was strange. I saw him gazing upon vacancy for long hours in an attitude of the profoundest attention, as if listening to some imaginary sounds. It was no wonder that his condition terrified, that it infected me. I felt creeping upon me by slow yet uncertain degrees the wild influences of his fantastic yet impressive superstitions. It was more than a week after we had placed the Lady Madeline within the vault that he burst into my room late one night. He stared about the room in silence for a moment, and then he abruptly turned to me and he said, "You have not seen it? You have not seen it? Oh, but you shall, you shall." And so speaking, he hurried to one of the windows and threw it open to the storm. The fury of the entering gust nearly lifted us from our feet. A whirlwind had apparently centered around the castle, blowing wildly, raising a tremendous noise. The clouds were exceedingly dense and low, so low that they touched the turrets of the house. Yet, in all of this, there was a light.
Under the surfaces of the huge masses of vapor which swept around madly was an unnatural light of a faintly luminous phosphorescence which paled everything in a ghastly, unnatural yellow. It rose from the stagnant swamp which surrounded the castle. I closed the window. And then I told Usher I would read to him from one of his favorite volumes. This I did. But as I read, Roderick sat in a chair beside me. He rocked from side to side with a gentle yet constant and uniform sway. And as I read, I thought I heard strange scraping noises coming from the inner parts of the house. Becoming more unnerved, I leaped to my feet, but the measured rocking movement of Usher was undisturbed. But as I placed my hand upon his shoulder, there came a strong shudder over his whole body. A sickly smile quivered about his lips, and I saw that he spoke in a low, hurried, and gibbering murmur, as if unconscious of my presence. Bending closely over him, I understood the hideous import of his words. Hear it. Hear the noise. The noise from the vault below. Yes, I hear it, and have heard it long, 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 many minutes, many hours, many days have I heard it. Yet I dared not speak. I tell you, old friend, we have put her in a living tomb.
Roderick, what are you saying?
Yes, I heard them many, many days ago, yet I dared not speak. Have you not heard the rending of her coffin and the grating of the iron hinges of her prison and her struggles within the archway of the vault?
Roderick, do you mean the Lady Madeline?
Yes. Where shall I go? She will be here soon, soon, soon. She'll scold me for my haste in burying her. She'll be here. Have I not heard her footsteps in the stair? Do I not hear that heavy and horrible beating of her heart? No! No, she's just outside the door! Just outside the door! As if in the superhuman energy of his utterance, there had been found the potency of magic, the huge antique panels of the door swung slowly back. There was the Lady Madeline of Usher. There was blood upon her white robes and the evidence of some bitter struggle upon every portion of her emaciated frame. For a moment she remained trembling and reeling to and fro upon the threshold, and then with deliberate slow steps she walked toward her brother, who stood petrified with fear. Finally, with a low moaning cry, she fell heavily upon Roderick and in her final death agonies bore him to the floor a corpse and a victim to the terrors he had anticipated. From that chamber of the dead and from the mansion I ran with all my strength. The storm was blinding in its fury. I ran out over the old causeway, crossing the swamp. And as I did, I suddenly heard a tremendous shot. I turned to see what caused it. God in heaven! The great building actually divided in two. Something blinding burst in the center of the castle, and it came tumbling down, down, down. The mighty walls burst into a million pieces. There was a long, tumultuous shouting sound, like the voice of a thousand waters. And the deep and dank tarn at my feet closed sullenly and silently over the fragments of the House of Usher.
From childhood's hour, I have not been as others were. I have not seen as others saw. I could not bring my passions from a common spring. From the same source I have not taken my sorrow. I could not awaken my heart to joy at the same tone. And all I loved alone. Then, in my childhood, in the dawn of a most stormy life, was drawn from every depth of good and ill the mystery which binds me still. From the torrent or the fountain, from the red cliff of the mountain, from the sun that round me rolled in its autumn tint of gold, from the lightning in the sky as it passed me flying by, from the thunder and the storm and the cloud that took the form when the rest of heaven was blue of a demon in my view. Lo, death has reared himself a throne in a strange city, lying alone far down within the dim west, where the good and the bad and the worst and the best have gone to their eternal rest. Their shrines and palaces and towers, time-eaten towers that tremble not, resemble nothing that is ours, around by lifting winds forgot, resignedly beneath the sky the melancholy waters lie. No rays from the holy heaven come down on the long night time of that town, but light from out the lurid sea streams up the turret silently, gleams up the pinnacles far and free, up domes, up spires, up kingly halls, up fanes, up Babylon-like walls, up shadowy long-forgotten bowers of sculptured ivy and stone flowers, up many and many a marvelous shrine whose wreathed friezes intertwine the viol, the violet, and the vine. Resignedly beneath the sky the melancholy waters lie. So blend the turrets and shadows there that all seem pendulous in air, while from a proud tower in the town death looks gigantically down. Their open fanes and gaping graves yawn level with the luminous waves, but not the riches there that lie in each idol's diamond eye, not the gaily jeweled dead tempt the waters from their bed. For no ripples curl, alas, along that wilderness of glass. No swellings tell that winds may be upon some far-off, happier sea. No heavings hint that winds have been on seas less hideously serene. But lo, a stir is in the air. The wave, there is a movement there, as if the towers had thrust aside in slightly sinking the dull tide, as if their tops had feebly given a void within the filmy heaven. The waves have now a redder glow. The hours are breathing faint and low. And when, amid no earthly moans, down, down that town shall settle hence, hell, rising from a thousand thrones, shall do it reverence.